This is The Guardian.
Während ich fahre, achtet der High-G-Beschleunigungssensor in meiner Apple Watch auf extreme Geschwindigkeitsänderungen. Der Gyrosensor achtet auf plötzliche Richtungswechsel. Und das Barometer reagiert auf Druckänderungen, wenn ein Airbag ausgelöst wird. So kann die Apple Watch Autounfälle erkennen und anbieten, Hilfe zu rufen. Ich muss einfach nur fahren. Die Apple Watch Series 8. Jetzt mit Unfallerkennung. Die Zukunft der Gesundheit. Am Handgelenk. Erfordert ein iPhone 8 oder neuer. Abhängig von Abdeckung und oder Verbindung.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Today, a panel of Galacticos in Wilson, O'Clare and Glendenning talk you through the Champions League draw, PSG, Bayern and Liverpool, Real Madrid, the standout ties and a bonus Barcelona, Manchester United in the Europa League. Meanwhile, who can afford Liverpool? Could they find a nice billionaire? Do they exist? We'll find out if Barry has an opinion on whether the new Southampton boss, Nathan Jones, is good or not. There's some World Cup squads to take a little look at, and there's a whole lot of off-the-pitch stuff to get into. FIFA send a nice message saying, isn't it time we just forgot about people dying and gay rights and just watch some football, because it brings people together. There's some authentic protests from German fans, some less than authentic protests from Big Beer, and we'll update you on the case of Abdullah Ibais, who Amnesty say is serving a 3-year prison sentence following an unfair trial in Qatar. All that, plus he's the fittest 38-year-old in the world, a fan of the pod. Your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel, Jonathan Wilson, welcome.
Morning, how are you doing?
I am tremendous, thank you very much. Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max Rushton.
Hello, Philippe Auclair.
Hello, Max.
Let's start with the Champions League draw. So the draw was made yesterday. RB Leipzig, Manchester City, Club Brugge, Benfica, Liverpool, Real Madrid, AC Milan, Spurs, Eintracht Frankfurt, Napoli, Borussia Dortmund, Chelsea, Inter Milan v Porto, and PSG versus Bayern Munich. It is the fourth time in 6 years that Liverpool and Real Madrid meet. What did Florentino Perez say about the reason for a Super League? Was so that these two sides could finally get to play each other? And we should caveat all of this with the fact that all of these sides could look totally different in terms of form, signings, injuries in February, but it is still fun to speculate. And before we do Liverpool-Real Madrid, let's do PSG-Bayern, because that is mouth-watering. Joey says, how much did Philippe laugh when PSG drew Bayern Munich after somehow surrendering first place in their Champions League group?
Yeah, I'm still laughing, you can hear.
What do you make of it, Philly? I mean, it's terrible for both of them, isn't it?
Really? I suppose so. I would say I was reading with interest, great interest, the preview that Jonathan has already done for the real paper this morning, and in which he puts Bayern, if I'm not mistaken, Jonathan, as favourite to go through. I would actually think that PSG have got a very decent chance this time, and as we've said, they're in danger of becoming a truly good side. The one problem they had was the risk of implosion in the squad after everything that happened with Kylian Mbappe. The rumours, which were actually more than rumours, of a disquiet in the dressing room. Obviously, we'll have to see how Neymar reacts to the loss of his favourite politician in Brazil, but he might have forgotten all about it a bit later on next year. But apart from that, they look far more balanced. They seem to have solved most of these problems, the situation in Mbappe. The three are working absolutely beautifully in front. Leo Messi, I wouldn't say he's back to his best, but he's certainly absolutely stupendous at the moment. Found his mojo again. Neymar is probably playing his best season for PSG. Mbappe has been blowing hot and cold, but is coming back as well. They look far more settled in midfield. They've got better fullbacks, which was a huge problem for them for a long time. And now with Nuno Mendes and Hakimi, well, you know, they've got what it takes. They look very strong, absolutely, throughout. And I also believe that they've got the right manager to prepare them for that tie. To me, it's very strange to say that, but as a team, if not as a club, they seem to me more settled than Bayern Munich, which is one of the reasons why I can imagine them actually going through that that particular round of 16 tie, which, of course, fills me with delight.
All of that's true.
Wilson?
The PSG look way better than they have done ever, probably. However, and also I've got doubts about this Bayern, not just because they've had a, by their standards, a pretty iffy start to the Bundesliga season. Yeah, the four draws, a defeat at Augsburg. Nagelsmann in big European ties does not have a good record. So there's all kinds of question marks about them. But PSG remain PSG until the moment at which they're a different PSG. And maybe this is the moment when that happens. But I watched the game against Juve and I watched the home game against Benfica. And in both of them, they had periods when they played brilliantly. And then they just sort of switched off for half an hour for no reason. And that's what did them at the end. You know, that draw against Benfica, which happened to be, this, I think, the day after the Mbappe rumours or Mbappe reports had come out. They let slip a position that they should never have let slip. And that remains sort of hardwired into the club. I also think you look at that forward line and, you know, Messi is playing brilliantly and Neymar is playing brilliantly, but none of the three of them really do any work. And can you do that against a really top side? Also, in terms of World Cup hangovers, I think almost whatever happens with Argentina, Messi will have a hangover. If they win it, his career's done. It's finished. It's over. He's completed the final quest. If they lose, he's going to be devastated. Neymar, not quite to the same extent, but it's not dissimilar. That he is the key to that Brazil. And if Brazil win, well, maybe spends a month partying. If they don't win, maybe spends a month sulking. Mbappe, you know, is prone to sulk if somebody looks at him funny at breakfast. Can you win a Champions League? Can you even win a big Champions League tie against a team like Bayern with sulky players that don't work? I'm sceptical.
Hang on, I'm trying to think, what's the worst situation then? Is it Brazil beat Argentina in the final and France are knocked out on penalties in the semi-final? Then you've got a partying Neymar and a sulking Messi and Mbappe. Is that the absolute sort of, that's the worst case scenario? But, and they've all played the whole tournament as well, so they're all knackered as well. I mean, I would say, Barry, for it to be really PSG-y, they would have to knock Bayern out and then go out in the next round to, you know, Benfica or Porto or something.
Yeah, I literally have nothing to add to what the lads have said. That was, they've pretty much covered all the bases. I think they probably will go through, but I still think they'll find some way to not win the Champions League. I really hope that's the case.
I mean, I genuinely feel sorry for Bayern here. Like, they've all the iffy domestic form, but they've just won 6 out of 6 in the group, including beating Inter and Barca twice. And what's your reward? Just play the club who's spent more money than any other club in the history of football.
Go on then, Barrett. Well, I'll let you go first on Liverpool, Real Madrid, and because otherwise there's a danger that you could just do that answer every
No, I was listening to the two lads and just mentally tick, 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 or any point I wanted to make, they've completely covered them, even to the Neymar going on the piss for 6 weeks or whatever, if Brazil win the World Cup. Real Madrid, Liverpool, I mean, Liverpool have been playing well in the Champions League this season, and their Champions League form has been completely removed to their domestic form, and I'm not quite sure how they're managing to sort of switch it on in the Champions League but not on the domestic front. I think this is a coin toss, basically. Liverpool are going to have to beat them at some point, aren't they? They've lost the last two in the last 2 years, but yeah, I do think it's a coin toss. I would be inclined towards Liverpool, I have to say.
Really? I'm inclined towards Real Madrid, but I guess it's, you know, once again, who knows exactly what Liverpool will be like in a couple of months. Wilson, thoughts?
Well, I think this has been a great draw for football. And by that, I mean football as the slightly cantankerous, mischievous old man who, despite all the crap that gets thrown at him every day and all the deluge of money, still finds a way every now and again just to tweak the nose of the people whose noses deserve tweaking. So for Perez to say last month, oh, it's a disgrace that Real Madrid and Liverpool have only met 9 times, and then football's going, all right, well, here's a 10th. And by the way, yeah, Liverpool, you know, they're out of the title race, so this is their chance to, yeah, this is the tournament they should be focusing on. I don't know how much difference that makes, but There's no sort of sense of Liverpool fighting a multiple fronts here. This is the front. I guess maybe getting in the top four, but you know they can win the Champions League, and that's what they should go for. If they get players back from injury, and injuries have been a huge problem for them, if they return, well, yeah, the squad is still really good. Their form against good teams recently has been good. I know Napoli had already won 5 games, had nothing to play for, but they beat them. They beat Manchester City, they beat Spurs. The light hasn't gone out completely at Liverpool. There's still something there. And I also think that Real Madrid midfield post-Casemiro, yeah, it looks good. Yeah, Tchouaméni and Camavinga, they add a sort of a dynamism and an aggression that maybe Casemiro can't bring. But it hasn't really been tested yet. The group was pretty straightforward for them. And Real Madrid lost last night, didn't they, to Rayo Vallecano? So they're not even top in... Yeah, they're behind... What looks a pretty average Barcelona. I thought Real Madrid were pretty lucky to win the Champions League last season. Or lucky maybe is the wrong word, but it wasn't this sort of...
I mean, really lucky.
Yeah, but if they were reliant on brilliant players doing brilliant things at key moments rather than this sort of unstoppable juggernaut of excellence. And you sort of feel that will be derailed at some point.
Philippe, can you see RB Leipzig causing Manchester City problems? I mean, I think they could be quite a dangerous team for City in a way.
Over a single game, perhaps, over two, I don't think there's a chance. That's the problem. And Manchester City, I think, is one of those teams that makes a doubleheader feels like a mini league almost. That, you know, they'll find the resources one way or another. Could be like diving in the 93rd minute, like they did against Fulham, you know, for Kevin De Bruyne. I'll never say that again enough. And they will find a solution. And Leipzig are doing very well. It's actually, by the way, quite amazing that they are the underdog and the nice guys when you think about who they are. You know,
it's big oil v. big energy drink.
And also Manchester City is one of those teams whose squad is so impervious to injuries and suspensions and the like. Whatever happens to them, they've got solutions, you know, which is not something that you would see almost any other team taking part in this Champions League. The resources are such that they won't be affected by that. And if need be, they will still buy some players in January if they think they're a little bit short in some departments, that they've only got 2 players for each position and they need 3. So no, I cannot see Leipzig do anything, but perhaps rattle them for a while, getting us excited about their play, scoring a few goals without a doubt, but getting out. That's really, yeah, sorry.
No, don't apologise. The other 2 English sides, Barry, I imagine Spurs will look at AC Milan and AC Milan will look at Spurs and think, that's not too bad. And I imagine Dortmund and Chelsea will probably feel the same about each other too.
Yeah, I think you're bang on there. I think there are 2 draws where just neither team have anything to be afraid of. Question, will Chelsea be on their 3rd manager of the tournament by the time this tie comes around? I don't know. It's possible. But they will see those ties as winnable. I would fancy Chelsea to go through against Dortmund. There does seem to be, and maybe it's just on Twitter where empty vessels make a lot of noise, but there does seem to be growing dissent among the ranks at Chelsea, or the ranks of supporters, with Potter already, which I find remarkable. People saying he's out of his depth and that he got that game all wrong at the weekend. But I would back Chelsea to go through against Dortmund, and I think I'd probably fancy AC Milan to go through against Spurs. But Spurs are tending to find a way, even if they're not playing particularly well at the moment.
Barca, Manchester United and Europa League, Wilson, is great, isn't it? Of the possible draws you could have. I guess Man United Ajax would have been fun from a Ten Hag point of view, but to have a game of that magnitude in a kind of playoff in the Europa League this early is wonderful.
And again, it's sort of football as this mischievous demon, just sort of saying to Barcelona, yeah, you thought you could spend your way out of this crisis. Nah. Yeah, we're going to give you a horrible Champions League group and you're going to fail in that. And then you're going to get Manchester United, who are improving and who kind of, I think, are actually genuinely motivating the Europa League in a way they possibly haven't been before. So, yeah, it's a, Europa League games, I tend to be pretty discerning with what I watch. You know, I certainly won't watch a game every Thursday. This one I'll absolutely categorically be watching. Largely because it's odd. I mean, maybe this is an age thing. But when that draw was made, my brain immediately went back to the famous tie in the Cup Winners' Cup in 1984, when United came from 2-0 down to beat Barca 3-2 at Old Trafford. And I sort of really had to think, oh, yeah, they've played him in two Champions League finals since then and in the Cup Winners' Cup final in 91. But I guess it's, you know, a two-legged tie. If it's anything like the game in 84, then it'll be tremendous.
Are Liverpool for sale? David Ornstein of The Athletic broke the story, I think, tweeting that Liverpool have been put up for sale by Fenway Sports Group. Sale deck has been produced for interested parties, which presumably is some kind of business type thing. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley are assisting the evaluation process. Unclear if the deal gets done, but FSG are inviting offers. FSG said there have been a number of recent changes of ownership and rumours of changes in ownership at EPL clubs. Inevitably, we're asked regularly about Fenway Sports Group ownership of Liverpool. FSG has frequently received expressions of interest from third parties seeking to become shareholders in Liverpool. FSG has said before that under the right terms and conditions, we would consider new shareholders if it was in the best interests of Liverpool as a club. FSG remains fully committed to the success of Liverpool, both on and off the pitch. Richard says, as a Liverpool fan, how do I avoid being completely effing depressed at seeing people wanting to get bought by a dictatorship if it means signing Bellingham and Mbappe? That top five records, how annoyed is Klopp going to be now he has to face questions about Liverpool being taken over potentially by a state after he complained about it earlier this season? What do you make of this, Philippe? Is there a nice, happy billionaire who might buy Liverpool and we can all be happy about it?
No, but there are probably about a dozen American investment funds who have already manifested an interest of some kind. The thing is it going to be a sale or is it going to be the sale actually of part of the capital is not absolutely clear. That's the first thing. The second thing, you've got to say that from FSG's point of view, I think they bought the club for £300 million. They have invested quite a bit of their own money. But if you look at the market value of a Liverpool, if you think that Chelsea was sold for 2.5 billion, plus, of course, the money that they had earmarked for development of the stadium and so forth, you're looking at, obviously, a sale price, which is much higher than that, you know, certainly over 3 billion. And you think if you're a businessman, which is what JW Henry is, and you look at how you can grow Liverpool beyond what it is now, you think, well, because the Super League, in which they were very much involved, has gone through the window, because their idea as well of reshaping the Premier League, you will remember that, with supposedly to help the lower rungs of the pyramid, and that went through as well. And, you know, they probably can't see ways at the moment to increase the profitability of the club over the medium and long term beyond what they've already achieved. So it makes complete sense for them to try and make ROI, return on investment, knowing that at the moment, American investment funds are basically knocking at the door of every club, small, average or big in Europe to try and get in the game. So it makes, I mean, that's not exactly something that makes you fall in love with the game, but there's nothing there that I find particularly shocking, because I don't know exactly what Liverpool fans were expecting from their owners. Did they genuinely think they came into the club because the JW Henry had a picture of Kevin Keegan in his boyhood bedroom? Of course not. So it makes sense from their point of view, I have to say. And in terms of where the game, where the club goes, it might not be a catastrophe. And as to another state coming in, I have to say that the cupboard is probably bare at this moment. The one perhaps that you could see is Bahrain. There have been rumors of the Bahrainis trying to get into Italian football in particular. So it's possible that they might be interested by a club like Liverpool. I'm not too sure that the fans would be too happy about that. And I'm not sure that the fan reaction would be the same that we've had in Newcastle. So the likelihood is, yes, you would have an American investment fund, another one, just getting in the game and trying to buy and to grow Liverpool in a different fashion.
I'd just like to see, I think, Elon Musk buy it. He's clearly bored. He has the money. So he could buy Liverpool, sack all the staff, all the players, and, you know, turn them into a basketball team or something. Just
wouldn't he sack all the players and invite them back? I'm very confused. I'm trying to keep up and I'm confused and I don't know whether I'm meant to leave and go to Mastodon. I've yet to log into Mastodon. I don't need another social media site. Can't I just let this die in front of me and then not join another one?
The first time I heard about that, I thought people were talking about Montydon, and which is a better name, by the way, than Mastodon.
I think Monty, let's face it, if Monty Don ran a massive social media, it would be quite pleasant, wouldn't it? It would be a nice place. You can only imagine. All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin by talking about the sacking of Ralph Hasenhüttl, which obviously happened a minute after we stopped recording yesterday.
Während ich fahre, achtet der Hi-G-Beschleunigungssensor in meiner Apple Watch auf extreme Geschwindigkeitsänderungen. Der Gyrosensor achtet auf plötzliche Richtungswechsel und das Barometer reagiert auf Druckänderungen, wenn ein Airbag ausgelöst wird. So kann die Apple Watch Autounfälle erkennen und anbieten, Hilfe zu rufen. Ich muss einfach nur fahren. Die Apple Watch Series 8. Jetzt mit Unfallerkennung. Die Zukunft der Gesundheit. Am Handgelenk. Erfordert ein iPhone 8 oder neuer. Abhängig von Abdeckung und oder Verbindung.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. A few tickets still to go for the live show next Thursday evening at Earth in Hackney. Me, Barry, Lars, Ellis, James, hopefully some cameos from people I might be looking at right now. We shall see. Head to theguardian.com/guardianlive if you'd like to come. Streaming it around the world as well. So wherever you are, watch us, please. So look, Ralph Hasenhüttl was sacked. We didn't need to do an emergency pod, Barry, because we basically presumed he had been sacked or was about to be. Southampton have been given permission to speak to Luton Town manager Nathan Jones. Our thoughts are with Faye Carruthers at this difficult time. The second time our thoughts have been with Faye Carruthers about Nathan Jones leaving Luton. I think, does that make sense to you?
Nathan Jones is clearly a good manager. He got Luton into the playoffs last season, despite the fact that they have, I think, only Blackpool had a lower wage bill than them in the Championship, and the Championship has a lot of teams with very big wage bills and budgets, and Luton are operating on a comparative shoestring. So that was a monumental achievement. He's done well, you know, and he did well to get them to the Championship. But the elephant in the room is obviously the time he left them to go to Stoke, and it was an absolute disaster. But a lot of managers seem to be failing at Stoke, so maybe there's something wrong there. Alex Neil left Sunderland to go to Stoke, and he's not having a very good time of it at the moment. I think he just lost his fourth match in a row. Can't say I'm too sorry for him, to be honest, but there you go. So maybe the problem at Stoke is somewhere else, the ownership, the staff, the whatever, the players. But I can't say I blame Southampton for looking at Nathan Jones. He seems to be a good young manager, but that his time at Stoke is a worry and is a concern. But it's a great opportunity for him, and I have no idea how he'll fare.
When we say we have no idea, I'm wondering if the Southampton owners have any idea. It's not the first time that they make decisions which are surprising to me, and maybe it will surprise you that I think it's a more surprising decision than it's been portrayed. I mean, they got rid of Claude Puel after he'd taken Southampton to the League Cup final, and they finished eighth in the Premier League because the football was not exciting enough. I think, okay, you're Southampton guys. And look at their transfer policy. Look at how Southampton prepared for this season, and you will see it's been abysmal. And it was a squad that needed quite a few reinforcements, and they've gone for cheap, young, some of them very talented players, but Hasenhüttl has been given an awful hand to deal with. And you could say, and I would say, that I think he's been overperforming with that team over the years, and that he's a very fine manager, and whoever takes him on will get a very fine coach indeed. So I'm not absolutely sure this is going to change anything in the fortunes of the club. They look to me like a club which is declining, is not making the necessary efforts to compete on the transfer market, and probably will be rewarded for that, if that's the word, by a very, very tough season and perhaps relegation. And I don't know. I know sometimes people say it's like the electric shock of parting with a manager, getting a new one. It can get you somewhere. But we're not in the case where, like an Aston Villa, where you get rid of a young and proven manager, basically, Steven Gerrard, and you bring in somebody who is a genuine European class manager like Unai Emery. You're not doing that. I can't see where the upgrade is. And it's also been shown, and I know that's a bit counterintuitive, that sometimes when teams are not going well at the stage of the season, when you compare, there was a statistical analysis, I think, by CIS about this, and when you change whether you change the manager or not change the manager, and the result is actually statistically almost the same. Like the new manager shock sometimes produces a few results, sometimes doesn't.
So no team should ever change their manager.
No, well, you know what I mean. Forever. Obviously, there are cases where you don't have any choice, but taken as a whole, the so-called new manager bounce is one of those, legends that football is ripe with. It doesn't automatically bring in the results that you expect, and in some cases, it actually can be detrimental. So I have to say, I find this decision understandable in view of the results, and perhaps not so understandable when you take into consideration the state of the club and the state of the team at this particular moment in time.
Joe says, does Arteta have Philippe's heart? Does he love this version of the Arsenal?
Of course I do. What more can I say? Of course I do. I haven't had so much fun. I can't remember. I've said it again and again. The atmosphere at the club, in the stands, is the best that I've ever experienced. And I include in this the atmosphere when the team was riding high in the early 2000s. It's incredibly exciting. There's a kind of togetherness that is experienced very rarely, and a sense of communion with the players, which is very, very rare indeed, in 21st century football. So we're having a ball, of course. Of course I'm enjoying it. I know it's not going to last forever. And also what he has achieved this season, I think, is totally underestimated, and it shows how skewed a perception has become and how expectations have become, just because there are a few super clubs out there who are regularly on almost 100-point seasons, and we think it's normal. It's not. What Arsenal has done since the beginning of the season is simply not normal. They haven't got the means of a Manchester City or a PSG or even a Bayern or a Manchester United.
Dicko says, insert my outrage at you not mentioning Ben White when talking about England choices at right back in this week's Football Weekly. He's been amazing this season. Should be on the plane, as you put it. Loving the rest of the pod, as always. Thank you, Dicko. World Cup squads are being announced. Wilson, did you like the Brazil squad where everyone who got in the squad videoed themselves? It's almost as if they already knew they were all going to be in the squad to be all filming themselves, unless there are lots of videos of Brazilians not making it and just being sad that we will never see. But they, there's loads of Premier League players in there. I don't know. You imagine they have quite a good shot at this.
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, they've only lost once in the last 3 years, I think, in 29 games, which is in the final of the Copa America against Argentina. They are playing really well. I slightly question whether they're over-attacking. That it's, Fred and Casemiro at the back of midfield plus four really gifted forwards. Is that enough against a really, really top class side? And I think that's one of the problems that non-European nations have building to this World Cup, that very few of them have been able to play against European teams. So Brazil, since they lost to Belgium at the last World Cup, have only played, I think, the Czech Republic. So they just haven't been tested. Argentina, similarly, Argentina on this 35-game unbeaten run. So they're two off the all-time record. But they've only played three European teams in that, one of them Estonia. Brazil and Argentina both look really good going into this World Cup, but there is that question mark there. At least Argentina played the Finalissima against Italy last summer and won 3-0 and looked very impressive. But yeah, Brazil clearly are one of the favourites.
They've got no Bobby Firmino, so maybe his video was there. It's almost like you've made it to judges' houses. You imagine Alex Telles hugging Louis Walsh and then diving in a swimming pool when finding out he's in the squad. Dani Alves has been picked, which has surprised a few. Because it's almost as if he's been picked just for bants. So he's for Chile, he's the Connor Cody. Case is seemingly Brazil have selected as a chief cheerleader for their World Cup squad. Do you think every team should dedicate one place in the 26 and identify them as such to provide bants? If so, who would make the key squads? Evra for France, Parler for England?
Well, I think there's, in the Wales squad, I think Chris Gunter's might not get picked, and people are saying you've got to take Chris Gunter, even if it's just for bants. You've got to take Chris Gunter because he's, you know, so many caps. He's been such a loyal servant to Wales, and it would just be absolutely crushingly cruel to leave him out. I think you can't underestimate the importance of having people who are good lads to have around the place, because being cloistered in a hotel at a tournament, I imagine, is quite boring. But you have to also be careful that it's not a sort of James Haskell, Archbishop of Banterbury, England rugby type who's going to be setting fire to your clothes or jumping out of wardrobes and scaring you and, you know, vomiting in your...
Taking your entire bedroom and then putting it outside exactly as it's made up. You can't see Chris Gunter. Can't see Chris Gunter doing that. The French squad, I mean, that's always been known for its, you know, happy bants and all those kind of things. What are you expecting? That's announced on Wednesday, Philippe.
It's announced Wednesday at 7 o'clock on national news by Didier Deschamps. The one thing, and I know this sounds really odd, apparently Deschamps hasn't made his mind up as to how many people, many players he wanted to take with him. I'm not inventing this. And one of the reasons for that is that he says we can only travel to Qatar with players who are fit. And obviously one of the biggest problems that he has is the fact that the number of players who are injured, including, of course, Paul Pogba and N'Golo Kanté, we know won't be there. Mike Maignan looks really, really iffy. There are quite a few other players as well. There's even a doubt about Karim Benzema at the moment. People are asking themselves questions because he keeps missing games for Real Madrid. So we don't know is the honest answer. I mean, some of the choices he made when France last played pretty badly in the Nations League have left people wondering as well if players like Camavinga and even William Saliba, if you can believe it, would be in his 23 or 26. Which is quite extraordinary, might have to do something with the fact that Deschamps never travels to see his players in the flesh and just entrusts scouts. He never comes. So there are an awful lot of question marks. Giroud seems to be in it. The rumours are that he will be one of the happy faces videoing himself a message of, let's go for Qatar. Or to quote Gianni Infantino, now is all.
Now is all. Surely Deschamps. I mean, he can't just watch Ligue 1. Like what? Surely he's going to some football matches.
No, I mean, he watches the games and so forth, but he's not one of those national team coaches who travels to watch players in the flesh. That's what he does, or rather what he doesn't do. So Giroud should be on the plane and with a chance, of course, of becoming France's all-time great goal scorer, which would be quite interesting. But no, there are loads of areas of doubt because he's keeping his cards very close to his chest. And the reason for that is because of the pitiful physical condition of many of his star players. Which is why when you were talking about France losing in the semifinals and penalties, I think it's more France getting out in the group stage. There's a part of me that keeps thinking that we're going to relive Korea 2002 with this particular group. The number of players who are just not fit is just phenomenal.
It's great that Christian Eriksen, who will come up against France in that group, is fit and is going after what happened at the Euros. Australia are also in that group. They named their squad. And down here, there's a soccer Twitter is a sort of is quite an exciting place to see what happens. And they're up in arms because the manager, Graham Arnold, has selected not the reserve keeper that the fans were expecting. I'm not sure if that's what's going to make the difference. It's my necessarily my thought to Australia. But anyway, those who will take that flippant remark and run with it, because it's been a huge scandal in Australia today. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Havard Smelnes from Josimar will join us in just a second, and we'll talk about the case of Abdullah Ibaiss.
Während ich fahre, achtet der Hi-G-Beschleunigungssensor in meiner Apple Watch auf extreme Geschwindigkeitsänderungen. Der Gyrosensor achtet auf plötzliche Richtungswechsel. Und das Barometer reagiert auf Druckänderungen, wenn ein Airbag ausgelöst wird. So kann die Apple Watch Autounfälle erkennen und anbieten, Hilfe zu rufen. Ich muss einfach nur fahren. Die Apple Watch Series 8. Jetzt mit Unfallerkennung. Die Zukunft der Gesundheit. Am Handgelenk. Erfordert ein iPhone 8 oder neuer. Abhängig von Abdeckung und oder Verbindung.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk about the case of Abdullah Ibaiss. We've talked about it before. He was the Deputy Communications Director for the Supreme Committee before being removed from the role in 2019. He was sentenced to 5 years on fraud charges. Human Rights Watch and Fair Square say they believe his confession was coerced and that he's been singled out because of his support for migrant workers in Qatar. Havard Smelnes from our friends at Josimar joins us now. Havard, lovely to see you. How are you?
Thanks. I'm fine, and thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. So what's the latest? He had an appeal rejected last week. On what grounds?
On no grounds, really. And since Wednesday, he's been put in solitary confinement. And the reason for this is that the guards discovered that he had written a letter that he was going to give his wife on her next visit. And also now is that he can only be given one phone call every 10 days. And they have threatened Abdullah, if he kind of escalate the situation, he will be banned from visits and calls for 30 days.
He's previously been on hunger strike. He's thinking about doing it again during the World Cup, isn't he?
Yes, he is seriously considering it. You know, he's been imprisoned for almost a year. For him, a mental roller coaster. That the court won't touch his case, it's really frustrating for him. He's in jail, you know, based on one thing and one thing only. And that was his forced confession.
And remind people, because it's been a while since we touched on the story, in what way did he support the migrant workers? What was it that changed from him being part of the Supreme Committee to not?
Well, in August 2019, there were these strikes, which thousands and thousands of migrant workers participated in at the Supreme Committee Crisis Comms Group, where senior members of the Supreme Committee are all in that part of that group, including the you know, the World Cup boss Hassan Al-Tawadi himself. Well, there was a strike at outside Al-Shahania, one of the most notorious labor camps inside Qatar, and on the Crisis Comms Group, they brought up the strike, but they also told that no World Cup workers were involved in that strike, and then Hassan Al-Tawadi instructed his group that we need to get our social media people to tell that this is not the Supreme Committee related. And then at this point, Abdullah Ibaiss intervened, because it was indeed 2022 related. Many of the strikers had been working on World Cup stadiums and haven't gotten paid for up to 4 months. Abdullah, argued against going to the media because many of the strikers were indeed World Cup related. And then at this point, you know, there was a heated dialogue or debate within the Crisis Comms group. And at this point, Hassan Altavadi leaves a voice message that basically said, "We need to put a spin on it." 2 months later, suddenly the SC started an internal investigation into a tender. One day, Abdullah Ibas was picked up by CID officer, the Criminal Investigation Department. They basically forced the confession out of him, several times to have a lawyer present. And then the CID officers will tell him things like, do you think you are in an American movie? You don't get to speak to a lawyer here. We can hide you here for 6 months and no one will know where you are. And Abdullah, a married man, a father of two small boys, got really, really scared at this point and, finally signed the confession.
Philippe, it might sound like a really obvious question, but why is this case so important? Or what does this case tell us?
First of all, it's a direct implication of the Supreme Committee, so you cannot say that it's not World Cup related. So it's perfectly legitimate for us to talk about it as a football subject here. Second thing, I think it shows you how Qatar functions as a police state and how its judiciary functions, where rights, which, by the way, are not Western rights, but actually are enshrined in Qatari legal system, are not respected, and that nobody... It shows you as well how vulnerable you are when you front up to the authority in that particular country, be it to the royal family or, in this case, to the Supreme Committee. It's very difficult not to... I don't have much else to say, to be honest about it, because I think the case speaks for itself.
FIFA's response to this has been a short statement issued on the 8th of November 2021, stating it is FIFA's position that any person deserves a trial that is fair and where due process is observed and respected. The Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy, in a statement last November, said Abdullah Ibaisi's claim that he was targeted for taking a position on a labour-related matter is a fabrication and a lie. The allegations presented by Ibaisi have no credibility. The case against him is rooted in evidence of alleged manipulation and misuse of state funds and has absolutely nothing to do with personal opinions or actions on labour-related matters. We've done podcasts on the treatment of migrant workers, amongst other things, which you will hear during our World Cup previews next week. But yeah, as I said, it's really worth going to Josimar, Josimar football.com to order your copy. Abad, always good to talk to you. Keep up the good work, my friend.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Philippe, you've done a lot of stuff with Josimar. You wanted to talk about the information wars that he brought up.
Yeah, because it's really nasty at the moment. It's absolutely toxic, actually, particularly on social networks. I'm not going to name names because I don't want to get you into trouble, Max, or producer Joel, having to cut so much of what I'm going to say. But one thing I find fascinating and quite in quite a horrible way is how they have been. There are now so many people from Western countries. They can be American, British, Swiss, German, whatever. Who are now speaking on social networks and criticizing the critics of Qatar. And these people are very often academics, people who are doctors, professors, and so forth, who suddenly are taking on positions which, when you look at it a little bit more closely, think, why are these people suddenly defending, or why are they defending Qatar to that extent, to the point that they sound like they're parroting the line of the regime? And what I would say is that it's an area that I want to look at, because I'm very interested in the links between some of these people and Qatari establishments and Qatari organizations. There's a lot of very devious information being spread at the moment. There is a lot of hypocrisy as well. I think we're going to touch on that in a second. But it is absolutely toxic, and there's absolutely no doubt in my mind then that some people who have a certain stature, notably in the academic world, are being used by the Qataris to further their message, which is a very aggressive message. Like, basically, what they're saying is, if you criticize Qatar, you're a racist. You know, that's basically it. It comes down to that, which is, of course, complete bollocks. But there are a number of people within Western academia who are quite willing to take on that position. And I have to say, we have to question their motives, and we should look at why they are taking this position, which absolutely, from the point of reason, makes no sense. And I'll be doing that.
Well, we know now that Qatar has paid fans. Yeah, you know, with 40 to 50 England fans, 40 to 50 Welsh fans, 40 to 50 Dutch fans. If they're paying fans, yeah, don't you know, there are other paid chills. They are paying people to put the right view out there. And you know, it's not just fans who are getting paid. And I think that is really, really obvious. You don't have to look very hard to work out who they are.
Interesting on that fan thing. There was an Australian fan called Paul Bateson, who was one of those fans, couldn't really afford to get to Qatar's, followed the Socceroos everywhere, has since it sort of come out, has had a change of heart and, you know, sent a big statement saying, you know, this is not how I want to follow my football team. So I think that was an interesting part of seeing what's happened with those fans who've been paid to go out there. We've seen protests in Germany, actually. Borussia Dortmund, Bayern Munich, Hertha Berlin all held up boycott Qatar banners at Bundesliga games. Another one read, Qatar, Abschalten, German for Qatar, switch off. It is interesting, Barry, isn't it? How there's just much more fan engagement there than perhaps anywhere else. I can't think of anywhere that's more engaged than there.
Yeah, and good for them. It's impressive to see. You would never see this in the Premier League. Doesn't seem. I don't know if it's because of the just Premier League grounds are quite dull by comparison to other grounds you see around Europe. Maybe because crowds are getting older and tickets are too expensive, and there isn't really an ultra culture in England where you have it in other countries. But it was very impressive to see. Probably won't do any good, but fair play to them for trying and grabbing our attention.
FIFA has written to all 32 teams competing at the World Cup, telling them to, quote, now focus on the football. It was signed by Gianni Infantino and Secretary General Fatma Samoura. We know football does not live in a vacuum. We're equally aware there are many challenges and difficulties of a political nature all around the world. But please do not allow football to be dragged into every ideological or political battle that exists. At FIFA, we try to respect all opinions and beliefs without handing out moral lessons to the rest of the world. No one people or culture or nation is better than any other. The principle is the very foundation stone of mutual respect and non-discrimination. And this is also one of the core values of football. So please, let's all remember that. And let football take center stage. We have the unique occasion and opportunity to welcome and embrace everyone, regardless of origin, background, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or nationality. CONMEBOL have backed this directive. I wonder, Wilson, as someone who's going, sort of how conscious you are of kind of the responsibility of covering everything when you're out there.
Yeah, and it's going to be very difficult because the World Cup is, you know, they're always incredibly busy. They're always incredibly difficult. And to an extent, and I'm very aware this will sound like a cop-out, my job's to cover the football to create the space for other people to cover the more serious stuff. But, you know, I will still, as far as possible, try and cover everything. But, I mean, the problem with that letter is, you know, the idea that homosexuality is an ideology is ludicrous. It's just who you are. So if the laws of a country present an existential threat to that, those two things cannot be reconciled. And, you know, I think it's very easy to get lured down cul-de-sacs about, you know, a Western liberal attitude sort of trying to colonise the rest of the world, imposing, you know, our values. FIFA statutes, Article 3, says, you know, there can be no discrimination on the grounds of race, sex, or race, gender, or sexuality. Well, manifestly, Qatar cannot stage a World Cup and abide by that statute. So the statutes mean nothing. And that's the statute that's been voted on by the entire FIFA Congress. So this World Cup goes against FIFA's own values.
BrewDog, meanwhile, have declared themselves an anti-sponsor of the World Cup in Qatar. We thought long and hard about whether we wanted to show matches in our bars, decided to do so for two reasons. One, if you love craft beer and love football, you shouldn't be denied the opportunity to enjoy them together just because FIFA is corrupt, their words, not mine. All profits from lost lager sold during the tournament we donated to human rights charities. We'll raise a lot more money if we show the matches in our bars. Philippe.
This is exactly what I'm talking about. These people suddenly realizing where we are, jumping on the table, and all they want is basically people to drink their beer and go to their pubs. And their beer is not even that good. I think, actually, by the way, I don't think this campaign has brought them the kind of positive publicity that they were hoping for, judging by the reaction on social media in particular. I think people have seen through that particular game very, very easily. It's actually despicable to try and make money on misery like this. I don't have any words. I would never set foot in a BrewDog pub ever again.
Look, obviously there's a lot to talk about with Qatar, and we've touched on a lot of it in quite a short period of time, but we have recorded specials, which you will hear next week. On quite the gear change, Tim says, does Barry know he's followed by the fastest 38-year-old in the world, Eliud Kipchoge? Maybe he's a listener. Can the pod wish him a happy birthday and congratulate him on his achievement? So yes, happy birthday to Mr. Kipchoge, who is a big Barry Glendening fan, presumably not following you for middle distance training tips.
I hope not.
My suspicion. And the Suffocated Kumquat Rap says, it's a cruel twist of fate that Twitter's death knell has sounded the same week we found out about Barry's corkboard, depriving us of what could have been an all-time great parody account. Sad times, he says. And that'll pretty much do for today's podcast. Thank you, Philippe, as always.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
We'll chat to you when you're out in Qatar. And Aaron says, what happened to Monday's pod for not saying thank you, Barry, and Barry replying you're welcome during the outro music? That is always the highlight of my day when a pod releases. Otherwise, love the pod. Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Christian Bennett.